Tonight, I have the distinct privilege and great honor of introducing a legend in my little area of the world as tonight's speaker. Mary Pearl from North Little Rock, Arkansas. Mary, it's all yours. Thank you.
Thank you, Dale. And as I tell people all the time, it's a fellowship of equals. There's no one any bigger or better than anybody else. Good Lord. A legend in my own mind sometimes, perhaps, but not in any other way. My name is Mary Pearl Thompson, and I'm from North Little Rock, Arkansas, and I am the surviving old-timer of the Rose City Al-Anon Big Book Black Belt Al-Anon Family Group. Yeah. Now, did that offend everybody? If not, I'll keep going. I'm supposed to share in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. Well, what I was like was I was a spoiled kid to the age of 12. I loved my daddy. We raised and trained bird dogs. I went fishing and hunting. I was a tomboy, needless to say, and I enjoyed so much. And then there was that other person that lived in our house. And that was the person who had been affected by alcoholism, the family disease. Her mother, father, brothers, sisters were all drunks. My mother was not. She ran away from home at the age of 13. So she was supposedly getting away from it all. But as we know, wherever we go, there we are. But anyway, my mother and daddy met in Memphis, Tennessee. And they got married, and everything happened. I am the youngest of four children. I was the change of life baby. There's 16 years between me and my sister. There was 20 between me and my brother, and 25 between me and my oldest brother, who was dead by the time I was born. So I was an only child. I was raised in a world of adults. My mother and daddy's friends didn't have kids my age, so I was just told to be quiet. You know, kids are to be seen, not heard. I made sure you saw me. you know how we are when we want attention. And I found out that attention, even bad attention, is attention. And my life changed on November the 30th of 1954. My father, I watched him die of a heart attack that night, and my world as I knew it ended right there. Now, I had been taken to church. We were big members of the Nazarene faith, and I was taught about a loving God, and I knew it was all a lie that night, because if God loved me, as they had told me, God would have taken my mother and not my daddy. Because I knew my daddy loved me. And so I was left with someone I didn't love, didn't like, and I was mad. I had a lot of anger started right there. I found that out when I did an inventory. All of my major defects happened by the time I was 5 or 6. I had learned revenge, and I had learned how to hate. I had learned to do a lot of things by the time I was a very small child. And I carried those things with me. Now, they were not necessarily taught to me, but those were my observations of what was happening around me. You know, kids are watching stuff. No matter what you say, they're watching stuff. And so, anyway, like I say, I wasn't a happy camper. Now, I was an overachiever. I was the straight A-plus student because my daddy was very much into education. He graduated from Vanderbilt in Tennessee, and then he went into the First World War, and then he was in the Second World War. And then my brother was in the Second World War, and he was killed in the Korean War. So we're a big military army family, not so big anymore. Anyway, in the late 50s, they built an Air Force base in Little Rock, North Little Rock area. It's Jacksonville, actually, but they call it Little Rock Air Force Base. And there was an article in the paper, and they said there was 10 men for every woman in the local area. And I thought, hot damn, I want my 10. And I want your 10 and your 10, because there's never too much of a good thing. Wow. And so it was wonderful. And besides, I wanted to get away from home, you know? So I met this boy at a bowling alley, and before we knew it, you know, we were going to get married, and we're going to be happily ever after away from her. And he told me, he said, I'm in the military. We'll take you all over the world. I said, good. And when we got our orders to go all over the world, we went to Newfoundland. Now, for those Canadians here, I know a couple of Canadians who are from Newfoundland, but it was not the place to go back in 1960. It was not high on my list. In fact, I'd never even heard of it and had to look it up in an atlas to figure out where it was. And I can tell you the worst thing about Newfoundland, it's boring. We had snow 9 months of the year. 9 months! And I'm talking about deep snow, you know, and so you can't get out and do much, you know. So it's boring. And so I found that there was excitement going on in the clubs on the base, in the Airmen's Club and the NCO Club and the Officers Club. They had excitement going on there because my husband played in the band. He was a lead guitar player. And we would all sit around these big round tables, and you'd buy a round of drinks for everybody. And I turned 21 when I was in Newfoundland, so I couldn't wait to get into the bar area to have one of those drinks and to have fun like everybody was having. And I walked in there, and I perched up on the bar stool, and the bartender says, what do you have? And I said, being a woman of the world, what have you got? You know, I think that's sort of a dead giveaway to the bartenders of the world that you are not experienced with alcohol. And so I had heard the word, and I said, I want a martini, please. And so he gave me, I took one swallow, and I tell you what, I turned inside out. I couldn't believe how bad that was. And I thought, I don't know how anybody gets to be an alcoholic drinking these. This is terrible. And so the bartender saw the look on my face. He came over, removed it, and put me a vodka Collins down. Hello. I had found a much nicer drink. And so I would drink while he would play. And then we had a room that was off to the side, and that's where we had the slot machines. Well, I had never seen a slot machine. And so now I have a lot of fun. I'm playing the slot machines. He's in there in the other room. Every time they'd buy a round of drinks, they'd send one out to me. And so I had all these drinks. I was drinking whiskey sours that night, and I had about four or five of them lined up in front of me. They were in the way. I couldn't even pull down the handle on my machine without them being in the way. So I drank them all, one right after the other, to get them out of the way and set them over there. Well, everything was okay for about maybe 10 minutes, I guess. I sort of lost track of time that night. And I did notice, though, that when I pulled my hand down, the handle pulled me back up. I couldn't feel my legs anymore. And I did not want to be what all the women in the world look at and go, oh, my God. And that's a drunk woman. You don't want to see a drunk woman. Men can get away with a lot of stuff. But women, when you see one drunk, that really goes downhill in a hurry. And so I turned to the gentleman on either side of me at the slot machines, and I said, gentlemen, I can no longer feel my legs. Would y'all please escort me to the ladies' room, lest I fall and make a mess of myself? And so they did. And I came to next to the toilet, and it was just so nice and cold, and it felt good, but I had messed all over myself and the floor and everything else. And so I knew then that that was not the thing for me. So don't ever down six or seven whiskey sours at the same time. Well, it embarrassed my husband. And so we had some conversation about it. I worked for the Red Cross on the base, and I was the assistant field director for Newfoundland and Labrador, and knew all of the people, all of the officers and everything, because you have to know everybody, and it was sort of a fun position. I was the only woman that worked in the whole office building. They put a little sign on the bathroom. There was just one bathroom, and they put a sign that was pink, and it said hers, and on the other side it said his. And so when I would go in, I'd just turn the sign around after I'd holler to see if anybody was in there ahead of me. Sometimes there was, sometimes they wouldn't say, you know, you're there with a bunch of military guys. What can I say? But I loved it. I love the excitement. I have always been addicted to adrenaline. That is my drug of choice. Well, I created a lot of excitement for myself while I was in Newfoundland. I created enough to cost me my marriage. But when it came time, we extended and were there for almost 5 years. And when it came time to come home, I called a guy in SAC assignment in Westover, and I said, "Where are we going?" And he said, "Oh, y'all are going to Minot, North Dakota." Minot? I'm not. I am not going to ice and snow again. He said, "Well, where do you want to go?" Well, remember, I couldn't wait to get away from home. Now, guess what? I want to go home. I want to go back to Little Rock. Don't you know it'll be all different back there now? You see, one more time, I didn't know wherever I went, there I was. And so the guy says, "Well, I don't know if we can change that. Let me see." And he said, "No, there's not an opening in your husband's career field." And I said, "We'll change it." And he said, "I can do that." And so with the strike of a pen, all of a sudden, my husband, who was an aircraft mechanic, overnight became a missile inspector at Little Rock Air Force Base. He had never seen a missile, but he was the head of the inspection team. Now, that ought to make you sleep well at nights. And so anyway, we came on back home. And the one thing I wanted to do when I get back home was I wanted to get rid of him. I realize that today. But I wasn't totally ready to get rid of him because there was a benefit that he came with. It was called an allotment check. And I was sort of a little bit of a mercenary person at that time. And so by the time they got it straightened back around and they got him, they said, "Well, now you've got to go to Wichita, Kansas." And I said, "I'm not going to Wichita, tornado capital of the United States. I'm not going there." And so he said, "Well, what do you," I said, "I'm just going to stay here." And so he said, "Okay." So he packed up. When he left, I said, "Goodbye." And I meant that. But I wanted that allotment check. Well, I was not to hear from him. Occasionally, I'd get a letter or something. Sometimes I might write one back. But it was like I was free. I was free. I didn't have my mother tell me what to do. I didn't have him to tell me what I could do or couldn't do, like as if that would matter. But I was free now. And you know what? I got bored. I got bored. There it is. One more time. And I noticed we had a neighborhood softball team. Men, women, all different ages. And I thought, oh, this is it. I have been out of the country. I have missed the hippie days. I will be a hippie now. So I got me some stretch boots and some hot pants, and I joined the team. And I loved it. I loved the camaraderie that we had. And after a game, we would go back over to somebody's house and we would discuss what we should have done, could have done, what have you. And some of them would be popping a top, or some of them would be sniffing some things, and others were smoking these little funny cigarettes, just a normal neighborhood in the 60s. And see, I hadn't had any of this in Newfoundland. I don't know where drugs were in the Newfoundland. I have no idea. Maybe it was under the snow somewhere. I don't know. But anyway, I was having them all over to my house after the game one night, and there was a boy on our team. He was 18. Well, that's not legal to drink in Arkansas. And he got drunk. And I thought, oh, my God. What if the cops pick him up, especially the sheriff? Because the sheriff and I had already had a few run-ins, and I thought maybe I should not let him drive home. So I told a few of them, I said, "Y'all follow me and to wherever he lives, and I'll drive him home." Well, he had a pickup. In the front seat of his pickup was this box with a China tea set in it. And I said, "What are you doing with a China tea set? An 18-year-old kid?" He said, "Oh, I got that for my mom for Mother's Day," which was coming up. And I said, "Oh, well," always being one to help. You know, I just, don't you love it, Bill? We're so helpful. I love the other day, Carol S. from Omaha said on her amends list, her eight-step list, was everybody she had tried to help. You know, that's who we know the amends to. But anyway, because we're just trying to help. I thought, well, I will take this in for him so he won't drop it and break it, because he was so staggery anyway. So we get over to his house and we go in. Now, I get this. It's about 2 or 3 in the morning. I'm going in a strange house, never been there before in my life, don't know the people at all, just the boy. And I'm carrying a china tea set, following him in the house. And he goes and leads me to the bedroom. He flips on the light in the bedroom, and there's a man laying on the bed in his jockey shorts. And he looks up and he says, well, hot damn, little brother, you brought us a broad home. And I said, well, not tonight, fella. And but that's who I'm married to. You know, when people ask me, how did you and JD meet? You know, that's sort of tricky. Now, in the program, I don't mind telling anybody that. But out there in the world, you know, they don't understand how things like that happen. But y'all do. So anyway, later on, that was around May. So later on in August, my birthday came up and I decided to throw a birthday party. Well, when I throw a party, I'm the Pearl Mesta of Rose City. And so I had a 3-day affair, you know, just come and have fun. And I prepared my house ahead of time. I had painted the walls black and had white paint on that with nudes and stuff that I had painted. And I had the black lights and stuff, so everything would be psychedelic looking. I've got to be a hippie, you know. And anyway, JD came with Roger over to the party that night. And he had told his brother, he said, you'd really like Mary if you got to know her. And he didn't know me that well. He wouldn't call me Mary. But anyway, you know, he'd been over at my house after the games. And so they came. And a few minutes later, I saw his brother leaving. And I asked Roger, I said, well, what's with your brother? And he said, you were too weird for him. Weird, weird. Well, him and the horse he rode in on. And so that was the way that went. And then about a week later, I had ended up with a kidney situation. And so the doctor had run some tests and everything and said that you can't drink for a while. And I said, that's okay. I don't mind one way or the other. And I went home. But I was an avid smoker. Now, Roger's had been bumming cigarettes off of me for a very long time. So I called him and I said, I just got home from the hospital. I'm tired. I don't feel like going to the store. Would you go get me a carton of cigarettes? And he said he would. And he did. And when he came back, he had his brother with him again. And they came in. Well, see, I've got my house back to normal now. Oh, that paint's hard to cover. Anyway, I've got my stuff back to normal in the house. And I'm playing my big stereo I got in Germany. And I was playing country western because that's what I had a lot of, since that's what my husband did. He played in the band. And JD enjoyed that. And I said, can I fix you a drink? And he said, well, I believe I will. And so he took a drink, and so did Roger. Well, I wasn't drinking. And then later on, Roger got drunk again, and he couldn't handle alcohol any better than I could. And JD said, I can't take him back home like this. And I said, well, y'all can spend the night. Doesn't matter to me. And so they did. And then they left the next day and went home. Well, JD and I started dating after that. I had a lot of fun. I mean, we had fun for about 4 years. And then everything changed. He asked me to marry him. Well, there's a time to tell things, and when you pass that time, there doesn't seem to be a good time to tell. And I had forgotten about some things, and so anyway, he asked me if I would marry him, and I said, oop, no, I can't. And he said, don't you love me? I said, that has nothing to do with it. And he said, what do you mean it has nothing? I said, well, I have a slight problem here. And he said, what? I said, I'm already married. He said, what? And I said, yeah, I'm already married. And he said, you sure didn't act married. I said, well, I forgot. That out of sight, out of mind stuff, you know. And So I explained to him about the situation, and he said, well, if I'd have known that, I said, yeah, I know, because that first night when you were talking to me, you were telling me about the no-count wife you had that ran around, and I said, I certainly wasn't going to tell you I was one of those, was I? And so anyway, I got a divorce on Monday, and guess who? We got married on Friday night. And alcoholism moved into my house. Now, I had no idea he was an alcoholic. I knew that sometimes he drank, and it was like going out with a whole bunch of men at the same time. There was the guy that picked me up who hadn't had a drink. He was just sort of namby-pamby, almost boring. There was a guy that had a couple of drinks. Now, this is my guy. He's having fun. I like this guy. We can dance. We can do all these things. And then there's the guy that begins to feel sorry for himself, and he wants to cry in his drink. And then there's the guy that gets a big mouth on him, about like a Chevy trunk lid that you can't shut down. So I would have to put him out of my misery. Well, that only happened a couple of times. So, you know, it wasn't a big deal. Well, we got married on the 7th of November. Thanksgiving's coming up. We had a party at my house. And guess what? The girl who had a totally stocked bar on November 7th doesn't have any alcohol in the house. Now I have a German Shepherd and a poodle. Who drank the alcohol? We've been robbed. The house has not been broken into. There's nothing wrong. But, you know, it's like all of a sudden the denial. It can't be things you don't want to be. It isn't. It's not hot. It's hell, but I'm not here. You know, it's just the way it is. And so denial entered my life. And, of course, after a couple of months more, then JD's drinking increased. And he didn't have to be good anymore. He was married. You know, like a woman don't have to watch her weight so much once she gets married. She can gain a few pounds. You already got him. Well, anyway, here he was, and he was drinking, but he would disappear. You know, they say it's an allergy. Well, he would break out in spots. Memphis, St. Louis, New Orleans, you know, those kind of spots. And he'd forget where he lived, and then he would come back home, and he'd act like he'd been gone 10 minutes. And, you know, within an hour, I was sure he hadn't really been gone. That wasn't that big a deal. Let's just go forth and forget about the past and move forward. And that's what we did, one day at a time. And I can tell you that will make you crazier than a squirrel, because the world is no longer real that you're living in. You're creating a world to live in, in which you can stand what you're living with. You know, you adapt. You know, they call it, you know, we adjust, and then we readjust, and then we maladjust, and then we're not adjusted at all. You know, at least that's what the therapist told me. But anyway, we had a problem other than the alcohol when he drank, and that was, it affected me when he drank. That anger that I had from the age of 12, and I had added anger to it for years. You know, instead of dealing with anger, you just push it down, push it down, push it down until it becomes a volcano inside of you. And when it would become a volcano, then the next thing that happens causes the volcano to erupt. And it doesn't have to have anything to do with the last person that did the deal. It's just that they happened to be the one that irked me, you know, just had to be whatever. And so violence entered our home, because I had been raised in violence. My mother constantly, if she couldn't bring blood or bruises, she wasn't happy when she was angry. She didn't know how to deal with her anger, and therefore I didn't. So, you know, you learn what you live with seems to be the norm. It's not a big deal. It may be a big deal, but it's not to you. And so I began to punish him. He became like my little boy. And when he went out and got drunk, he did what I told him not to. So when he came home, I would whip him. And I'm not proud of that. I'm not proud of being an abuser. I'm not proud that I broke his bones. I'm not proud that I knocked his teeth out. I'm not proud of any of that. But that's the kind of world we were living in. And then I would go to work each day as none of that was happening. I lived in two different worlds. I had the world at work, and then I had the world at home, and God forbid the two should meet. You know, you got to keep it a secret there. And I learned in here, we're sick as the secrets. You know, those are the things that keep you sick, is the secrets. That's the reason we do a fourth step, to get those secrets up to the top. And then on the fifth step, we tell somebody else to get it out so we don't have to live in that hell anymore. But that's where I was. Well, I kept telling him, and I kept explaining to him why he didn't need to drink. And he would say, "You just don't understand." And I'd say, "Well, tell me and I will understand." And so he would talk to me and I'd say, "That's crazy." He'd say, "See there, I told you you wouldn't understand. Because how do you understand crazy?" Like as if I would have understood normal if I heard it at that point. Because I wanted him to stop drinking. If he'd just quit drinking, our lives would be okay. That's not true, but that's the lie I told myself. Because you see, I'm having to lie to myself on a daily basis now about my own behavior, and I would excuse it by justification and rationalization. If he didn't do this, I wouldn't have to do that. So I became innocent, pure as the driven snow, perfect wife. His mother was on my side, so that was pretty, until I beat him up one time too many, and his daddy told him, he said, "Jim, you let that woman get the pants on. You got to go over there and get them pants back, boy." And so he went and liquored up, and he came home to get the pants back. And, you know, if his daddy kept talking to him, he might have got him killed, because that was probably one of the worst episodes we had when he decided to take the pants off. Anyway, we're going along, and I'm working and doing more things. And during this period of time, I had a really important job at the company that I worked for. And I was the administrative assistant to the CEO of the largest insurance company in Arkansas. And we were having an anniversary party for one of our agents. And we were going to have it at the new country club. Now, in Little Rock, there's the old country club. That's old money. And then there's the new country club. That's the new money. And it's not near as prestigious to go to new as you go to old, but it was cheaper. So I made the reservations. I was in charge of the anniversary celebration, got everything fixed for to have over at the country club. Now, I decided I would have my mother, who was an excellent dressmaker and designer, I had her to make me a dress. And I had designed, I wanted it out of royal blue velvet with blue chiffon sleeves, with an empire waistline, with a border of lace with rhinestones and stuff around it, right under the boobs. And I mean, it looked good. And I decided, my hair was very long and black, and I decided, I had seen on a picture of Elizabeth Taylor on a magazine at the beauty shop that she had it in these cascading curls. And I thought, now that would be something special. So I had them pull it up and do these cascading curls. And then I went to Merle Norman to get my makeup done, because this is going to be a production, y'all. I'm in charge of this big deal. And so I get over there, and they convinced me that I need to have some eyelashes. They said, "Here, these are called spiders." Now, I don't like spiders in any way, shape, or form. Why would I let them put something on me called a spider? But these things were so long, if you blink, you flog yourself. But anyway, they got them glued. They don't weigh nothing on your finger. They weigh 10 pounds on your eyelid. I mean, you're just like at half mast, you know. I mean, it really takes a while. You got to really put effort in it to hold your eyes open. Well, off to the country club we go. Well, I walk in the country club, and I happen to look over to the side, and there is a woman who has on a dress exactly like mine. Exactly like mine. And I'm going, how can that happen? I designed it. My mama made it. How could that happen? So we go over and we sit down at this table, and I'm there with a bunch of the other people that I know, and we're all there. And I said, "Did you see that woman over there?" And they said, "Yeah." And I said, "She's got on a dress just like mine." And they said, "Yes, she does." And I said, "Can you believe it? It looks better on me than it does on her." And I was so fascinated, I couldn't even keep my mind on what was going on. Well, we had a little break, and so I got up to go and check with her and find out about that dress that was just driving me crazy. And so as I went to meet her, she came to meet me because I'd been looking at a mirrored wall that whole night. I had been looking at him, and yet I had given him this big talk about, don't embarrass me. don't embarrass me. Nobody can embarrass me as well as I can myself. I just kept right on walking and went out. There was no coming back after that, y'all. Somebody had to take him home. I couldn't, you know, I just couldn't do that. And they teased me about that at the office for a very long time, you know. And I said, but that's what you get when you're trying to be something you're not. Then you don't even recognize yourself in a mirror. You know, that shows you how unlike me I was. But I was trying to be. But anyway, so then, like I say, of course, you know, this, it all gets worse. And then finally I told him, I said, I'm going to take you to the doctor and get something for you. And he said, well, I have some friends that's taking a drug called Anabuse. Maybe that'll help. And I said, whatever. So we went to the family doctor. He told him he had a slight drinking problem. And I thought, boy, that means the Titanic had a bad day. And, of course, you know, the queen of sarcasm here. And so the doctor told him, he said, you know, people who deal with drinking problems, I believe there's a group of people called Alcoholics Anonymous, and they seem to have better results than anybody else does on this. And he said, I'm not an alcoholic. I said, that's right. He's not. You see, my grandfather had been an alcoholic. My grandmother had been an alcoholic. But he was not going to be like them. I wasn't going to let that happen. And so he said, well, he said, if you take this drug and you drink with it, it can make you very sick or in some instance kill you. So you might want to think about that. And what I heard was, you can give him this pill and he can't drink. So I became the administrator of the pill. Well, by now I have an epileptic dog. I've got high blood pressure. Of course, that has come along with a lot of other physical ailments because my nerves are getting a little close. And now I've got him on the pill. So every morning in the hurry going to work, I can't guarantee who got what, but by God, everybody got a pill. And so off we went. And then we'd come back. You know, it's like at the boxing match. You know, you ring the bell and then y'all come back again and you have your fight in the middle and you go to your quarters. That was sort of the way it was at my house. But now he's not drinking. Now, I just knew if he quit drinking, everything would be okay. It wasn't okay. That's when I realized it wasn't the drinking. It was him. It was him. Because I'm still having problems here. It has to be him. It can't be me, you know. And so I began to think on that. Well, see, that's not good. Because we were having war every day. We would get into a cuss fight over something every day. And so that's the summer that the committee moved in with me. And I began to think, now that's the worst thing we can do is think. I have to be careful. I have to run my thinking by people. Even to this day, I have to run my thinking because sometimes my desires are not in line with God's will at all. And anyway, I started thinking, and you know, the conversation went something like this in my head. Oh, God, I am so miserable. Me too. Well, why don't we get a divorce? We can't get a divorce. Why can't we get a divorce? Well, if we get a divorce, I mean, what's the common denominator? You've already been, I'm not going there. Okay. And so then we'd have another meeting a few days after that, and we'd sit around and discuss it. And then one night, one of the Mary Pearls said, well, you know, if you were a widow, what? What was that? If you were a widow, oh, I like it already. Then that would be honorable. You wouldn't be like a divorcee again, another failure again. In fact, like I say, but he's not dying. Well, we can take care of that. Oh, how do you want to do it? Well, frankly, I want to take an ice pick, stab him in the neck, and watch him drip. Oh, my God. That was just, it gave me good goosebumps. It felt so good. And so we began to think on that. And then I read in the paper where a woman had killed her husband, said he was an alcoholic. And, you know, they put her butt in jail. That wouldn't have happened if I'd have been on that jury. I can guarantee you that. So now I've got to go back and have another meeting. And later that fall, it came to us. If an alcoholic were to pass out in the bathtub and drown, who would know? Who would know? We all liked it. It was a group conscience. And so all you have to do is wait because, you know, sooner or later, they're going to drink again. They always do. And so sure enough, he drank again. And when he came in this time, I heard him. We had had some ice and snow here in Little Rock. And most people here do not know how to drive on it, probably any better than they do in Georgia. And Anyway, I heard him coming down the street because you know the sound of your vehicle. You've been listening for it for years. You know it. And I hear it, and it sounds like he's doing about 40 in second gear. And he came across the yard. He went sideways across the yard, and he hit a tree, missed the driveway completely. And I thought, boy, he can't drive on this ice. And then he opened that truck door, and he poured out. I'd seen that too many times, and I looked out that window, and I said, I'll kill that SOB if it's the last thing I ever do. And so when he came through the door, I never said a word to him. I just hit him as hard as I could. And we used to have a coffee table that sat in front of the couch, and he fell and hit that coffee table and knocked himself out. And I went over there, and I grabbed him by the feet, and I pulled him into the bathroom. I turned the filled the bathtub full of warm water. I took his clothes off of him, and I put him in the bathtub, and I held him under because I wanted him dead. And a voice came, and it said, you can't do this. Look what you're doing. And I said, picked him up by the hair of his head, and I said, the hell I can't. And I put him back down again. And then the voice said, do you not realize you're taking someone you once loved? This is murder. No. This is justifiable homicide. No, it's murder. Well, that scared me to death. Not from the fact he was going to be dead, but I didn't want to go to jail. Because, you know, it's all about us. So I jerked him up out of that tub, and thank God I had worked for the Red Cross. I was able to resuscitate him. And so then I drug him into the bedroom, put him in the bed, dried him off, put him in the bed, got the hair dryer down and dried his hair. I didn't want him to catch cold. Now, people say, you want him dead but not a cold. No, no. Women, let me ask you, have you ever been around a man with a cold? They never have a common cold. They have Hong Kong flu. They have pneumonia. They have anything, and they are the whiniest. So, and have you noticed that when you have a cold, you have to continue to cook and clean and do all the work? But when they do it, they take to their deathbed. You ever notice that? I could have him dead. I couldn't have him with a cold. That was shows you where I was. And I came in the living room, and I got in this old rocker that I have in here, an antique rocker, and I rocked for hours. And I knew I couldn't live like that any longer, but I didn't know how not to live like that any longer. And I heard him holler and what have you, but I didn't go back in that room because I was afraid of what I might do if I went back in there. Well, a couple of days later, I come home from work, and he's sitting at our bar, and he said he had that piece of paper that the doctor had given him that had the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, would you call this for me? I've been trying all day, and I keep getting the wrong number because of the push-button phone, him shaking like he was. And I said, what can a group of drunks do for you that I haven't done? And he said, I don't know, but I know I'm going to die if I don't get some help. And so I picked the paper up, and I called the central office for Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a lady there. Her name was Mary Peeler. She's in that big meeting with them. And a wonderful, wonderful lady. And she talked to me, and she told me, she said, honey, there's a meeting at Rose City. I said, I'm in Rose City. She says, there's one in about an hour's time, and it was just 6 or 7 blocks from my house. That close. And it was a building that was built by my grandfather, who died of wet brain from alcoholism. I had gone there when I had been a scout. We took meetings there. It was a community building. And weddings and church services and various family reunions and AA rented that building. And so I took him to his first AA meeting. And there were two ladies that came over and said, we're Al-Anon. We're here for you. And I said, what do you mean for me? And they said, well, we're here for the families. And I said, there's nothing wrong with me. And so they just backed off, went over and sat down. You know, denial is a great thing. And so guess what? There's an old man that looked worse than Grandpa did when we buried him. And he came over and he said to JD, boy, I'm going to be your sponsor. I was not impressed. And so, but that old man saved JD's life. They didn't say, wait till you find someone you can relate to, do this or that. You know, they got him some help that night. And so he began going to meetings, and every time he'd go to the meetings, some of those Al-Anons would give him pamphlets to bring home to me. Can you believe it? That I wouldn't read that trash, but I didn't throw it away. Don't know why. Just one of those God deals. And then there was the night that he didn't come home after the meeting, and I knew he and the old guy both got drunk. And as it turns out, they were on 12-step call, but I got to looking through that literature, and there was a little card that said, my name's Earlene, if you ever need to talk. It's 11:30 at night. I want to talk, Earlene. And so I called and woke her up, and she was just as kind as she could be, and she explained to me, and they had me, well, if I ever need that, thank you very much. And so his sponsor came in with him to prove that they'd been on a 12-step call, because I didn't know what that was. And JD knew that he was in trouble because he was late. And so anyway, it rocked on. And then the next week, JD, who could drink on the job, he's a welder. He couldn't drink and weld shaking. You know, he wasn't drinking, so he was shaking. And he couldn't well, so they fired him. Now, isn't that a thing for God to do? If God's going to be helping you, why would he take away the income of that, you know? And I was making a lot more, but it didn't make any difference. I couldn't have made enough money to pay for the bills and stuff that we had, all of us together, because he'd spend money we didn't have for alcohol, so I'd spend money we didn't have just to show him that he wasn't the only one that could do that. Now, that is crazy. But, you know, when he quit drinking, that stopped that. It took me 4 years to pay off my little happy trips to the mall. I decided JD got fired. And when he did, I just sort of caved in. I mean, I didn't have another plan. I had done everything I knew to do. I was through. And so I went to the Al-Anon meeting. And there, God knew. Those two ladies, they'd only been in Al-Anon 4 months. They had just a pamphlet and a couple of pieces of literature from a World Service office, and they had never been to another meeting anywhere else. And so they sent two ladies, God sent two ladies from the oldest meeting west of the Mississippi to meet that meeting that night. And they shared their experience, strength, and hope with me. And it was like somebody had been looking in the windows of my soul. And so they told me where all these different meetings were and everything. And so every time JD would go out the door, every night, we would go to a meeting. And I get tickled at people nowadays when they say, can you believe 90 meetings in 90 days? Well, I went for 2 years before we missed a meeting, for God's sake, you know. And even then, I told my sponsor, I said, I'm not going to be there tonight. I'm going to take a night off. And she said, okay. And when after the meeting, I got to wondering and wondered what the meeting was about. And so I called her and she said, well, we'll never know what you missed. You see, we all went and we got what we were supposed to get, but we'll never know what it was you missed. I thought, that is the meanest thing to do. Now, you know, I mean, to do me like that. But, you know, it keeps you in the meeting because you got to know. And there was a little old lady that came to the meeting. I think probably I was in the program about maybe 6-7 months, and I got a sponsor right off. And because Al-Anon had that many sponsors, but I loved the open AA meetings, and they were always talking about a sponsor. See, the AAs were having fun. They were laughing, and the Al-Anons were not, you know. And so I said, okay, I wanted to be an alcoholic. I really did. I just couldn't do the deal. But anyway, I was, like say, going to all these meetings, and these people are complaining. And I said, I want to have fun. I want to have fun. And my sponsor says, well, why don't you work the steps with me and we will have fun? It just took me a long time to get to that point. I was so broken. And, you know, I had wanted a mama all my life that would just love me unconditionally, that wouldn't always punish me and find the one thing I'd done wrong. That was my sponsor. That was my sponsor. And I was raised in between my living room and hers. And in her living room, there was her husband and another man that were working on a study, a big book study that they were going to take around the world. So I was raised on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous from the get-go. There wasn't anybody to say, you can't do that back then. I came in January the 15th of 1977. And it was not real popular. The other Al-Anon groups were, oh, no. But, you know, it's just from my line of sponsorship, which happens to go back to Lois Wilson, and she used it, so we used it. So anyway, we began to do that. And over at my home group, it was that little old group, I told them, I said, you know, we were meeting in the corner of that building at the same times AAs were, with a petition between us. So you had to be quiet so you could make sure you heard what they were saying or they could hear what you were saying. And so I said, you know, I only live seven blocks away. I said, why don't we meet over at our house and y'all can meet over, the AAs can meet over there at the building. Because back in those days, everybody in AA had someone in Al-Anon, just like Renell was talking about in the history of Georgia Al-Anon. You know, everybody, and it wasn't any difference between AA and Al-Anon as far as the fellowship. We all get together. They couldn't have been nicer to me all those years. They couldn't. There was no yang-yang going on between the fellowships. And so it was a good time. And so they'd come over here. Well, one night there was a girl and her husband was still drinking. And all of a sudden he knocked on the door in the middle of our Al-Anon meeting that we were having here at the house. And he had a rose bush in his hands. And he says, I brought you some flowers. And I thought, oh my God, I hope that's one of JD's rose bushes instead of one of my neighbors. I hope that is one of ours. It wasn't. It was one of the neighbors. But anyway, we just took him and put him to bed in the bedroom and let the AAs work on him when they came by after the meeting. You know, we used to do stuff like that. We'd go out after the meeting and the Al-Anons would go on this side of the restaurant and we'd talk and the AAs would go on the other side and they'd talk over there. And they begin to teach me about the love and the fellowship that we have. We are so blessed. You know, that's where I learned God goes ahead and plans in love. God knew what we needed, and God did it, you know, and everything went according to the plan, even though you don't think it is. Well, I didn't know how to pray. I didn't have a God other than one I was mad at. And my sponsor told me I could borrow hers, which I did for a while, and then she told me to take actions, like she said, pray about it, and I didn't know how to tell her. I didn't know how to pray. And she told me, well, it's real simple. You just say please in the morning and thank you at night. She said, we can start there. It's real simple. Anybody can do that. So that's what I did. And then there was the convention that was coming up, the old granddad in Hot Springs. And they said, his sponsor and mine both said, y'all ought to go. And I said, how can we go? He's out of work. He's been out of work 6 or 7 months. How can we afford to go? And so it was like, pray about it. And so I said, okay, that was her solution to everything. Still is. That's because the solution is pray about it. And so I asked him, I said, do you want to pray about this going to the convention together? And he said, do I have to say anything out loud? I said, no, you do not. And we just knelt by the side of the bed and we held hands and said, God, if it be your will, we'd like to go to the convention. Thank you very much. You know, nothing fancy. And the next morning I got up, went to work. We had a Watts line back then, and I called Hot Springs, made reservations. 30 minutes later, JD called me, and he had a job. Isn't it funny how all of that just fell into place? God's will just goes right into place. And who would have thought? So now I'm saving money for us to be able to go to a convention, but I can't save my bill money to do it. I've got to continue to pay the bills in addition. And so I finally figured it all up. If we eat cheese and crackers in the room and we just have to pay the registration and we can't afford to go to the banquet, this is what it's going to cost. And so I looked at him and I thought, what in the hell is he going to wear? Because that's the days of leisure suits and he smoked. Well, you know what happens with the ashes. They go down, they melt. He looked like a colander. And I said, it can't take him like that. Have to get a new suit. There was a brochure came in the mail and it was two pairs of pants, a reversible vest and a jacket for $49.95. I said, it can't be much. Can't be much, but what the heck? And so I ordered it and it came in the mail. And by this time, it's the week of the convention. And I have the reservations. That's it. And I paid for the registration. And now I've got no money. I said, I've got a bare minimum of $35 in order to do this deal. And I don't have it. And so he was putting on the suit. It came in the mail. And he said, just a minute, something's wadded up in the pocket. And in the pocket was a 20, a 10, and a 5, our $35. And we sat on the floor and hugged each other and cried. Who would have thought to tell God to put it there? Who would have thought? See, my God has a sense of humor, and he does stuff that in such a way as I know it has nothing to do with human beings. It has everything to do with God. He does the God stuff. Instead of us trying to play God, we do not have the ability nor the sense to do that. Anyway, we went on, went to the convention, and somebody at the convention bought our meal, every meal while we were there. And it came the night for the banquet. And of course, we didn't have any banquet ticket. And the envelope came shoving under the door, and in it were two banquet tickets. And they were at the table with the speakers. We fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous and conventions at that deal. That's when it just really, you know, I still have goosebumps when I think about that. Anyway, life goes on, and we begin to try to work it, and we did it at home. We tried, but our sponsors both, and this was wonderful suggestions, advice, instructions, whatever you want to call it. She said, forget about your relationship. You don't have one. And not a healthy one. And she said, work on yourself. You can't bring to the relationship what you don't have. So it's going to have to start with you. And so I thought, oh, Lord, here it is. It's going to have to start with me. And so that's what we did. We just sort of lived in the same house. We ended up driving in two separate cars to the same meeting, because we couldn't get there without having a fight coming or going one. So you just take two separate cars. You do what you got to do. And then the next year, I realized at the end of the year, I had begun to respect him now. And see, I had lost all respect for him during the active drinking, during that active drinking. And like I say, I hadn't paid that much attention to him in sobriety because I'm trying to do my own thing. And so I told my sponsor, I said, well, if things are going pretty good. She said, okay. And then I told her, I said, I've got an idea. You know, I said, let's learn how to do the traditions in our relationships. And I began to pray about that and study about that. And after a couple of years, I came up with some, but that's another story. But anyway, the main relationship that I had screwed up for a lifetime was not the one with JD. It's the one with my mama. My mama is the one that I couldn't be. I couldn't be around her in the same room with her 5 minutes. We weren't at each other. Just could not do it. And my sponsor told me, she said that when you feel like you've got to tell her, shut up and go home. Don't say another word. Just go home. And I'd say, well, can you? And she said, you can do it. And I knew that when Mama called, she told me, she said, hang the phone, tell her, hang on and put the phone down and go pray. I'd go to the bathroom and I would say, God, it's her. Please put a bubble around me and one around her so we don't hurt each other. God, please do that. And then I would go pick up the phone and I would listen, because when you talk to mother, you listen. And so I'm a lot. I found out the first inventory I ever did, I took my grand sponsor's inventory because I didn't like her. And then one day it occurred to me, the reason I didn't like her, we were so much alike. And that's what I had in common with my mother. We were so much alike that we couldn't be together very well. And so I wanted that to change. And so my sponsor told me, she says, well, why don't you ask God to see your mother the way he sees her? I said, what? And she said, ask God to let you see your mother the way he sees her. So I began to pray that prayer, and I prayed that prayer way over a year. And I said, how long do I have to pray this dumb prayer? She said, oh, just till it works. I said, oh, well, just till it works. Okay. So I go back to praying the prayer. And then one fall, I went over to my mama's, and as I'm driving in, we have a long driveway. And as I was driving in, I look out in the back field, and mama's raking leaves. My mother is short. What? I realized my mother was short. Now, how could you not know your mother was short? Because every time you come as a child wanting something from your mama. And when you're a child, mama's big. Oh, my God. And as I walked back, I looked inside my mama's heart. God let me see in her heart that there wasn't all that love I thought she withheld to punish me. It just wasn't there. And if anybody was going to have to bring love to the relationship, it was going to have to start with me. Let it begin with me. Anything you want in life, you've got to be willing to do it first. You've got to be willing to put it out there, because what goes round comes round. It will come back, might not be from the area in which you do it, but it will come back to you. And I thought, they've taught me how to love in Al-Anon. They've taught me how to love. I'm going to have to bring love to her. So I walked over her and I asked her to put her leaf broom down, and I gave her a hug. Boy, she was stiff as a poker, you know, because we don't touch, we don't talk, we don't hug. Good Lord, none of that stuff. And she just looked at me and I said, I needed to do that for me. And so every time I would go to my mother's after that, I would make sure I hugged her before I left. And after a while, she began to stand up and walk toward those hugs. She wasn't hugging back, but she was doing the best she could. And then one day I had been to the bank, and it was like I was there in the line at the drive-in. It was like, go see mother today. Just as clear, go see your mother today. I said, okay. So I left the bank, went straight down to my mother's. And my mother said, let's have a talk in the sewing room. I said, okay. And she says, there's something I want to ask you. I thought, oh God, what is it? And she said, how come you became such a rotten, ornery kid after your daddy died? And I said, because I was getting even with you for not loving me. And she said, what do you mean I didn't love you? I gave you a roof over your head, food to eat, clothes to wear. It was more than I ever had. Remember, she ran away from home at 13. She lived in an alley in the early 1900s. Wasn't fashionable. There was a lady had a boarding house on that alley. She told my mom if she'd come and do work there, help with cleaning and serving, that she could have her room and board. And my daddy worked for the Army. He was quite a bit older than my mother. He was head of the recruiting office for the Army. And he took his meals at that boarding house. And that's where they met. And when she was 16, they got married in the parlor of that boarding house. Why did she run away from home? Because her father, when he was drunk, was very abusive, physically, emotionally, and sexually. And he had tried to rape her. And so she ran. Her mother drank. Her father drank. She had no one there to protect her. So how, why would I expect her to know how to love me? And you see, I thought that what she was talking about was food and clothes and a roof over my head. That was something parents are supposed to do, aren't they? But if they're sick, if they have a disease, they might not be able to do that. And my mother had the family disease of alcoholism, the same disease that I have, the family disease of alcoholism. I am just like the alcoholic without the need to drink, but I need the alcoholic to blame for everything that goes wrong in my life. You know, we got to have somebody to blame. Can't be us. Anyway, and so when she said that, I realized, you know, I had sponsored so many girls that had been raised in alcoholism, and I realized I hadn't really thought about what she was doing for me. I just saw what she wasn't doing for me. You know how we look for the negative instead of the positive. And so I looked at her, and I knew I had tried many times to make an amends to my mother, and it never worked, because I really felt like she owed me the amends until that day. And I said, Mama, what can I do to make it up to you at this point in life for all those things that I've done that have hurt you? So many of them I did on purpose. What can I do to make it up to you today? And my mother looked at me and she said, forgive me for not being the kind of mother you needed. Now, I don't know if she was or if she wasn't, but that's what God had for me. And I said, Mama, I forgive you. Because you see, my sponsor has told me, when you ask somebody what you can do to make an amends, and they tell you, if it's humanly possible within reason, you do it. And if she needed to hear the words, I could say the words, I forgive you. And I realized I had forgiven her for being damaged by that alcoholism. And my mother got up and she walked across the room and she hugged me and kissed me on the cheek. And she said, baby, I love you. I've always loved you. And I knew she had, to the best of her ability. And that hole inside of me that I'd had for a lifetime closed up. I didn't have that yearning and wanting her to be different than what she was. That hole closed up. I am grateful. There are so many things she did over the years I didn't like, and I look back at it, and she was trying to teach me values. You know, today we were talking about principles. And I thought, I know when a sponsor said to me, what principles do you live by? And I didn't know what she's talking about. You know, had not a clue what she was talking about. But today I know. And it's the principles of that 12th step. And why? Because I've had a spiritual awakening. That's what I'm guaranteed in that 12th step. If I do those 11 steps in front of it, I am guaranteed one thing, a spiritual awakening to a power that's greater than me that will solve any and all problems that I will ever have. I have been able to tap into a power, and I'm so grateful. And I also realized that that sister that was 16 years older than me had no children, and she had treated me like a mother all my life, but I didn't give her credit because I was looking to Mama for it. And when she would do it, I didn't give her credit because I wanted Mama to do it. So I discounted them both. So then I made an amends to that sister, and I'm so grateful. And my mother died on the 1st of February of 1991. She had had a series of strokes, and I was able to go to the nursing home after I would walk every day. And my mother would see me coming, and she would run and put her arms around me and give me that hug. Couldn't talk. Her throat was paralyzed and everything. She was on a feeding tube. But my mother loved me, and she did the best she could. And you know, my mother, who didn't love me, I have a very expensive German piano in my living room. She bought that for me when I was 5 years old because I could play by ear. And I took music lessons from classical pianists. And I went to competition and won awards and stuff from the mother who didn't love me. You know, and I look back at it, I'm thinking, dear Lord, what all did she do for me? All my life she was doing things for me, and I didn't give her credit because it wasn't what I wanted. I wanted her to hug me and tell me she loved me. Well, she finally did. But, you know, I was in my 40s before I heard that. And I wasted that much of my life wanting something that she didn't have. And all I had to do was just forgive her. because I think, you know, when it was Mother's Day, it was hard to send a card that says Happy Mother's Day, bitch. When she wanted one of those sweet ones, and I just couldn't bring myself to send in those sweet ones, and my sponsor made me. And I realized when Mama died, she didn't keep one of those funny cards, but she kept every one of those cards that said, you're a good mom. You know, she needed to know that she was okay as a mom, as bad as I needed to be okay as a child. That's what I wanted, was her approval. I wanted her approval. And I would have thought it was love if I got the approval. But it's a lot of difference between love and approval. Y'all have taught me that. Working these steps has taught me that. Because, you see, it's the God kind of love that we give to one another here that is so healing. So very healing. And God goes ahead and plans in love. If you don't think so, what would have happened to AA and Al-Anon without Zoom? What would happen to this world? The virus is nothing compared to a bunch of untreated alcoholics and Al-Anons, let me tell you. You know? But God created a method for us to see one another. And it has been hard to get used to not hearing a response back when you talk, you know. I told somebody, they said, well, it should be the same. I said, all right, I'm going to tell you, go stand against the wall, put your nose against the wall and tell your story. It's real fun, ain't it? You know, because you don't get the immediate response that you used to get, you know. But nonetheless, I retired from speaking in 2012 because physically I can't walk anymore. And travel had become just way too difficult. And I was here, but the Zoom made it come alive again, beginning to get to come. I'm so grateful to have been invited to share with y'all, because I can't tell you how much being amongst you and being able to go, well, you know, one of the things I always wanted to do, I had on my bucket list for a long time, was go to Australia. Well, hell, I can go to Australia anytime I want to. I got my mate over here that will invite me anytime I want to go, and she's going to come here to see me next year. And, you know, I said, where in the world could you be in San Francisco, go pee, and go to Australia? I mean, I'm a time traveler, for God's sakes, you know? It's fun. It's made it. And you can go to meetings anywhere in the world, any time of the day or night. And so sometimes if I find a little boredom in one, I can go to another one, you know. And I love to go to the meetings. I love to go in here. I have learned more since last year when this COVID started and we started. I have learned more by traveling because I've met so many different people and how they do it. And it's just been marvelous. My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I do not choose the colors, but he worketh steadily. Oft times in sorrow, sometimes foolish pride, I forget he sees the top while I the underside. Not till a loom is silent and the shuttles cease to fly, will God unroll the canvas and explain the reasons why. But the dark threads are as needful in a skillful weaver's hand is the threads of gold and silver in the pattern God has planned. Thank you for having me.